From UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation, this is Tales from the South, recorded in front of a live audience at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas. Each week, it's an intimate dinner with everyday Southerners on our unrehearsed show, telling their story, as if they were sitting on the porch with you. So sit back, relax, and reconnect with the power of a story. Now, let's go live to Tales from the South.
And I thought that man knew, Lord, I was a human being.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Nick Devlin and Amy Garland Angel? What y'all think? You can hear more from Amy Garland Angel on ReverbNation.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? What do y'all think about our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight's show is about lessons. Sometimes we learn them from our parents, sometimes we learn them from strangers, and sometimes we learn them from a child. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Jill Duvall thinks she's helping another, but then turns the mirror on herself. And we'll end the night with Wendy Russ as the layers fall away and the lesson is revealed. But let's start the night with Murray Edwards in 1963 as a life lesson is shown, not told, in Catafalques and Silver Bullets.
Unlike some passions which develop gradually over time, my fascination with state funerals began precisely on June the 6th, 1963. As only an 11-year-old boy can do, I blasted through my ranch chores that morning and hurried back to the house, flipped on the television just in time to catch a rerun of The Lone Ranger. Even though the plot never varied much, generally cattle rustlers causing trouble or some shyster lawyer cheating a widow out of a ranch, I loved seeing the masked man present a silver bullet to an appreciative victim and then gallop on his horse saying, "Hi-o, silver, away!" That particular morning, however, there would be no return to the thrilling days of yesteryear. The networks were broadcasting the funeral of Pope John the 23rd. Watching the television coverage, it was pretty obvious those Catholics knew what they were doing. With a couple of thousand years to practice, they'd already buried 22 other Pope Johns before this one. As the commentators reverently whispered the details, pallbearers carefully lifted the Pope's body from a fancy gold-covered resting place. The TV guy called it a bier, where heads of state and dignitaries had come to pay their respects and slowly move toward the cathedral. Dozens of wrinkly-faced men wearing red pointy hats swarmed around the Pope, reminding me of bees carrying their dead queen out of the hive. Once inside the church, the most beautiful I'd ever seen, pallbearers placed the Pope's body on a more magnificent bier, something the TV commentator called a catafalque. where a hidden choir sang centuries-old Gregorian chants and soaring Renaissance hymns. I imagined the singers to be hooded monks from some mountain monastery who had ridden their overworked donkeys all the way to Rome for the ceremony. I was lying on the floor in front of the television, absorbing the majesty and dignity of the spectacle, when my mother called me from the back porch where she had been sweeping. When I went outside, she told me she had found the body of my cat, Smokey. Even though our family had anticipated Smokey's death for several weeks, I felt just as sad as all those cardinals and archbishops who presided over the Pope's funeral. When Dad came in for lunch, he said he'd help me dig a grave and bury my pet later in the afternoon after he'd finished working cattle. But after lunch, when the television announcer made another reference to the cat of Falk, inspiration came to me, as if sent directly from heaven. Boys that age are constantly searching for ways to occupy their time other than work or chores assigned by their fathers. So, with the telecast of the Vatican pageantry providing my blueprint, I decided to channel my grief into an equally complicated state funeral for Smokey. Of course, instead of columned and fountained Rome, the ceremony would take place on a cactus-infested cattle ranch in parched West Texas. First, I needed to find a suitable coffin. Rummaging around the trash pit, I discovered a wooden peach crate left over from our spring trip to Fredericksburg. Placing my cat's body inside, I loaded the flimsy box into my radio flyer, tied the wagon to my bicycle, and solemnly pedaled to the hay barn. There, Smokey would lie in state on top of a catafalque consisting of three hay bales stacked one on top of the other. Earlier, the television commentator described the custom of an officer of the papal court formally calling out the Pope's name three times, a medieval tradition from the days when the archbishops, lacking any knowledge of medicine, wanted to make certain the Pope was truly dead before he was entombed. Even though my cat was already stiff, I followed the protocol, loudly calling out Spokey's name. The next part of the ceremony was making the official death announcement. Fortunately, one of the barnyard cats had followed our processional, providing the required audience. The Vatican official used a lot of Latin phrases to proclaim the pontiff's death. But the only Latin words I remembered from school were e pluribus unum. Neither Smokey nor the audience ever knew any difference. By this time, the barnyard cat had become bored and left the funeral, depriving me of a dignitary to pass by the catafalque and view the body. Unfazed, I loaded Smokey back into the radio flyer for a ride to the cathedral, which consisted of cedar fence posts stacked 5 feet tall and 6 feet wide out in the pasture. With no hooded monks to sing Gregorian chants, I struck up a chorus of "What a Friend We Have in Jesus," the standard for all the funerals I'd ever attended. Recognizing the need to offer some sort of final prayer, I bowed my head and asked God to bless Smokey because he was a good mouser and to give him a special place in cat heaven. I couldn't think of anything else to say, mainly because Smokey's positive attributes were pretty well limited to that one specific talent. Rather than digging a grave, as Dad had suggested, I decided a tomb would be more fitting and certainly more papal-like. By moving and rearranging a few of the cedar posts, I transformed the cathedral into Smokey's final resting place. I carefully positioned the peach box in the stack of cedar posts and said my last tearful goodbye. By the next day, the world had returned to normal. I slapdashed through my chores in time to see Tonto save his Kemosabe from bank robbers who had taken the masked man hostage. Over in Rome, the Catholics were busy electing their next pope. Just before lunch, I told Mother all about the funeral and the tomb I'd constructed at the cedar post pile, but her reaction wasn't as I'd expected. As her expression darkened, she said coyotes or buzzards would likely find Smokey's body and make quick work of him. I hadn't considered that factor, and the thought of nasty buzzards devouring my pet made me cringe. Not waiting to eat, I hustled to the tomb, expecting the very worst. There, in front of the cedar posts, as I dreaded, was a dismantled peach crate and a patch of fur lying on the grass. Tears welled up in my eyes as I imagined the coyotes making a tasty meal of Smokey. But as I turned to begin the painful walk back to the house, I noticed some freshly turned soil, a mound of sorts, on the other side of the posts. At one end of the pile of dirt, someone had placed a makeshift cross, crudely nailed together from two pieces of the peach crate. On the cross piece, the word Smokey was written in pencil. Dad never mentioned what he had done that day. Looking back, I'm not sure how he knew cat meant so much to me, and how devastated I'd be to discover my mistake of not burying Smokey. Sometimes the best lessons in life are shown, not told. And perhaps, like the Lone Ranger, Dad preferred anonymity to glory. Maybe building that homemade cross was his way of leaving me a silver bullet.
Murray Edwards is a West Texas agribusinessman, a graduate of Texas A&M and Harvard. His short fiction collection, Looking for Lucy Gilligan, was named one of the 10 best books for 2009 by Texas Writes. In our next story, Jill Duvall's lesson comes in the form of a stranger turned friend in All of It.
When the referral came in, the nurse said they had an AIDS patient who was dying all alone and would live only a few days. His name was Robert something, a 42-year-old black male. On the first two visits, Robert stayed quiet. Occasionally, I'd say something nice to him like, "I'm so sorry you're sick," or, "I know it's weird having a stranger in your room." Robert would open his eyes after I spoke, but he never said a word. On the third visit, he spoke for the first time. "What kind of female are you?" "What do you mean?" I ask. "I mean, what kind of person would come to my room like this?" I could see his point. It was depressing as all hell. What kind of fool would come and sit with a stranger who was dying and sit in quiet for hours? "Well," I said, "it is my job, and I do like meeting people, and you don't seem too bad so far." I laughed out loud because although I felt I knew him, he had never shared anything with me. "Tell me who you are," he said. Now, in the professional world of medicine and psychology, one does not tell one's personal information to a client or patient. But when a dying man asked me a simple question, I couldn't think of a reason not to answer. "I'm 26 years old, from Arkansas. I have naturally curly hair. I love to play tennis. I have two brothers, a mom and dad, and I got my master's last year. I'm in a serious relationship, but not married yet. How about you?" Robert laughed. "I don't think you want to hear my story. It don't sound as good." "Oh, I've heard it all," I said. "There's nothing you can say that will upset me." He laughed again. "Oh, yeah?" He went on to tell me that he didn't feel right telling a story, given his situation. "What situation is that?" I asked. "With this problem I have, the AIDS." I was used to this part. All my clients felt guilty for having AIDS, felt embarrassed, almost like they were embarrassed to be dying so young, like if they were better people, they could live longer. I waited a moment and said, "Illness strikes good people and bad people, Robert. Viruses don't take an inventory before they infect you. Like mosquitoes, if you're human, you can get bit." He chuckled and reached for my hand. "Did you come to see me because I'm going to die or because I have AIDS?" "I came because it seemed you needed a visitor. Everybody needs a visitor when they're sick." That satisfied him for the day. He closed his eyes and fell asleep, and I kept holding his hand until I had to go. Over the next few days, Robert told me his story. He was born in the sand hills of North Carolina, dropped out of high school, and joined the Army in 69, and went straight to Vietnam. He said in his first few weeks there that he was given heroin to help him cope with the job. He said they passed it out like candy. Once home from the war, he became a truck driver, crisscrossing the United States. Now, in graduate school, I was trained to be direct, honest, and open about race. I thought I would try this technique with Robert. I would state the obvious, that I was white and he was black. Robert was so serious when I first brought it up. The first time I mentioned it, I said, "My supervisor wants me to see if my being white is causing a problem for you." Robert asked if he had offended me somehow, causing me to ask him this strange question. That was hilarious to me to think that he would offend me when it was far more likely that I would offend him. He reassured me that he didn't care if I was white because I couldn't help the way I was born. Over the next 3 weeks, I visited him every day and a deep friendship grew between us. I would kiss his cheek on my way out of his room and he would bow his head down and slightly turn his cheek away. It became clear he was not going to die that hospitalization and would be discharged home. I remember him saying that he never expected us to be friends, and I agreed. We had absolutely nothing in common. He was in his 40s, black, a former Ivy drug user, a truck-driving Vietnam vet. I was a college-educated white girl who thought hard times were student loans. But we were the same. About a year later, I got a call from Robert at the office. He was driving through town and wanted to say hello. We agreed to meet at the Starvin' Marvin gas station just off of I-40 in Chapel Hill. I was excited to see him. On the way over, I realized that I'd never seen him in street clothes or behind the wheel of a car. And although I felt a deep connection with him, I wasn't sure I'd recognize him. I got there early and waited. An older Cadillac pulled onto the road in front of the station. Sitting in the driver's seat was a black man scanning the parking lot. I saw fuzzy dots hanging from his rearview mirror. On his left hand and on the steering wheel, I noticed several gold rings sparkling in the lunchtime sun. Robert parked his Cadillac a few cars down from me. As I got out of my car, I saw his sweet face down the row. He was much heavier, dressed up fancy. He had on a purple dress shirt and brown dress pants. His sleeves were rolled up halfway due to the heat of a summer day. I started towards him, but as I approached, I noticed a row of white construction workers sitting on their tailgates watching us. It occurred to me for the first time, in a flash of a moment, that I was not supposed to hug Robert. I was shocked to think this and looked at him. What was even more shocking is he said, "You don't have to hug me if you don't want to." In that moment, I realized that he'd seen those white construction workers like I had, knew the racial norms better than I, and was prepared to give me an out. I knew I wasn't supposed to hug him. I was afraid one or both of us would be attacked. "You've got to be kidding," I said, and hugged his neck long and hard. We moved to his car and sat and held hands and talked for almost an hour. But I was sick to my stomach the whole time we were talking. It was not the white construction workers that made me sick, or Robert's rings and his fuzzy dice. It was not the AIDS crisis and all the young men dying. It was not my mama's childhood fear of black men, or my daddy's silence as his black teammates ate their dinners in back kitchens. It wasn't that I knew I would have been afraid of Robert if I'd seen him in another setting. And it wasn't because I loved him. It was all of it.
Jill Duvall is enjoying her 50s and is close to finishing her first mystery novel. On the weekends, she is either home writing or out hiking, bird watching, or traveling through our beautiful state of Arkansas. In our final story of the night, a child is the catalyst for Wendy Russ's lesson in The Sum of Layers.
In my 8th year of motherhood, I was sitting on a hot concrete bench cooking up a dose of melanoma under my generous helping of freckles. In front of me was a baseball field covered with boys of all shapes and sizes. At my feet, my youngest, age 4, my Romeo with his coal black eyes and eyelashes long enough to scrape the underside of the moon, plowed a fire truck through the dirt. On the field was my other boy, tall and strong, fair-skinned, orange-haired, blue eyes. When I look into his eyes, I think of my great-grandmother, who always thought blue eyes and red hair was the most beautiful combination in the world. This boy, my oldest, was heading up to bat. With a crack, the ball sailed through the air, and a cheer went up from all the moms and dads and coaches. He began to run. First base, second base, then suddenly something went wrong. I don't even remember now what it was, because what happened next knocked every memory of that moment out of my head except one. My son kicked up dirt as he grimly shuffled off the field to the dugout. One of the coaches caught him just as he crossed the baseline, but before he could reach the dugout. He grabbed him by the shoulders and squared him up until their noses were about 2 inches apart. I scooted to the edge of my seat, ready, at the slightest provocation, to fly up on that coach like the most insane soccer mom banshee from hell. My heart raced. The coach started in, "Do you know what you did wrong?" My son nodded and looked down at the ground. With a gentle shake of my son's shoulders, he commanded eye contact. In the background, I heard another crack of ball against bat and a cheer. It drowned out the conversation that held me, but suddenly the image was transformed. This man, talking to my 8-year-old son as he would speak to another man, demanded in a respectful way that he do his best, that he be his best, that he be a good team member, that he rise to meet challenges. My fair-skinned boy, with his delicate dusting of freckles, sun-kissed, set his lips determinedly. He nodded at whatever the coach had to say, then stood an inch or two taller. And as I watched them, I was reminded of a phone call I had with my mother-in-law 6 years earlier. My oldest had just begun to transition from baby to toddler, and I had fallen into a funk. I adored this precious baby, and he was leaving me, growing into something different, someone different. I loved the new guy, but I really missed the old guy, even grieved for him at times. In this mood, I just didn't see the point of motherhood. You have this blessing come upon you. You care for him, let him consume you, turn your life upside down, and suddenly, in 18 years, which seems more like 18 hours, he's packing his toothbrush, his clothes, his favorite book, his condoms, for heaven's sake. And as you stand on the porch crying because he's leaving you, he'll head off into his life, and you hope he'll be a fabulous human being, and you hope he'll leave the world a better place than when he came into it. But the more likely scenario is that he'll just be another mediocre human being with a big carbon footprint who forgets to call you on Mother's Day. Or worse. My husband's mother had called on a particularly bad day, and I asked her, how does she reconcile that her son is all grown up? How can she bear that her little boy doesn't exist anymore? Does she miss him terribly? Does she grieve for him? I could tell by the silence on the other end of the phone that she was bewildered by my question, and subsequently, I felt stupid and filled with regret that I'd even asked. So I put it out of my mind, or tried to, for months, then years. In unguarded moments, the thought would peek around the corner like an evil leprechaun and plague me with more visions of me crying on the porch. Eventually, my second son arrived, and there were so many new challenges, no time to do much but put one foot in front of the other and keep on moving. Time sped forward, and there I was in the hot summer sun, watching as my freckle-faced 8-year-old boy kept solid, unwavering eye contact with his coach. And then I saw it. I saw the layers of him, the baby, the toddler, the preschooler, the boy who graduated from kindergarten,
the one who learned to read, the one who lost his baby teeth, the one who made it halfway to home plate after hours and hours of batting practice. They were all there, transparent, three-dimensional, like nesting dolls. And I realized the reason my question was so ridiculous, so alien, is because my mother-in-law knew, but couldn't explain, that you don't have to grieve for your loss because there is no loss. This boy is just layers, like a rich archaeological dig, the sum of those layers of love, of discipline, of fun times, of hard times, of learning and experiences. I watched the coach slap him on the back and send him into the dugout where he was jostled by his friends, all elbows and nudges. I smiled and drew circles in the dirt with my foot next to the roads my youngest was carving out with his truck. "You're messing up my roads, Mom." "Sorry, sweetie." During the next round, my oldest was up to bat again. I was awash with a newfound serenity. He sidled up to the plate and planted his feet squarely, rocking back and forth to get his perfect balance. Elbows up, a couple test swings, he nodded to the pitcher, "Ready." The ball flew, the bat sped forward. The batter's form poetry as metal met leather, and with a loud pop, the ball torpedoed between flailing players desperate to catch it. My son began to run, and I began to cheer. I cheered for him, but I think now I might have been cheering more for me, for us, for a future free from looking back with sadness, but now only fondness, or at worst, nostalgia. I cheered as he veered across second and didn't slow a beat, just like coach had taught him. On to third, the coaches screamed for him to run. A slight pause rounding third, and I slid forward on that hot, rough, blazing bench. Halfway to home, he turned to look back. The ball was coming, coming straight for him, coming straight for home. I leaped up and I ran to the fence, hooking my fingers through the chain link, and I screamed, "Run, run, run, and don't look back." As he crossed home plate, I cheered for him, for us, as he thrust his fist toward the sky and whooped long and loud. And from the dugout came a roar as the boys raced onto the field victorious.
Wendy Russ is a writer from North Central Arkansas. She is currently putting the finishing touches on her first novel, an adventure tale set in the South. She can be found online at wendy.com. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? What y'all think? Thank you to all of our writers. Thank you to our live audience. And thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website. For more information, visit talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. Studio time by Infrared Studio Productions. Graphics by Robin Steves at Studio B. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.